This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. Thank you so much for listening on this, our final broadcast of 2016. New Year's Day is just 2 days away, so let's take a minute and review some of the year's biggest headlines. Here's one. Pope Francis endorsed Donald Trump for president. Secretary Hillary Clinton actively armed ISIS jihadists. Child sex abuse ring discovered in Washington, D.C. pizza restaurant. Now, those, you've probably already guessed, are false, fake news headlines. But what happens when the real news, the statements coming directly from people in power or those about to take power, become indistinguishable from fake news?
So one thing that has been interesting this entire campaign season to watch is that people that say facts are facts, they're not really facts. Everybody has a way. It's kind of like looking at ratings or looking at a glass of half full water. Everybody has a way of interpreting them to be the truth or not truth. There's no such thing, unfortunately, more of fact.
That's Scotty Hughes, a Donald Trump surrogate when she was on the Diane Rehm show at the beginning of December. And that stark statement leads us to another. This from author Peter Pomerantsev when he was on this show in November.
You know, facts aren't actually very pleasant. You know, facts tell us basically we're going to die. We're nothing as good-looking as we think we are. Probably, you know, going to be poorer than our parents. And that our countries, in the West especially, are in decline. And the only time you really need facts is when you've got a clear, coherent, and very tangible future to aim for.
What Peter is saying there is a staggering disappointment to Jay Rosen, who's dedicated his career to the institution that's supposed to deliver those facts. That's the press. Rosen is the author of Press Think. That's a blog about journalism in the digital age. He's also professor of journalism at New York University. In a new post for Press Think, he outlines the prospects for the American media and for truth as a consequence during the next 4 years of the Trump administration. Jay Rosen says there are a few bright spots, a handful of possible solutions, but mostly there's cause for alarm and concern when it comes to preserving a cycle of fact-based knowledge in America that's driven by quality journalism. Jay Rosen is in the studio with me now. Welcome to The Takeaway, Jay.
Thank you very much, Tom.
You've painted a picture of what seems like a perfect storm of insidious and conspiring factors that are making the press less effective and less vital in the age of Trump. What's the picture of what's going on here?
Well, the picture is of multiple overlapping problems in which journalists aren't trusted, especially by Trump supporters. And they have their own problems, such as a declining economic model and a broken model of political coverage that, for example, failed to anticipate the results. And they now confront a figure in power, Donald Trump, who breaks the norms of American democracy and, even more disconcertingly, doesn't seem to care whether his statements cohere with one another, doesn't care whether he spreads falsehood, seems intent on producing confusion as almost a political tool, and is ready at a moment's notice to attack the press and whip up hatred against it among his supporters. So when you put all of those things together, along with the difficulty that our press corps has in rapidly shifting routines and changing the way it does things, it's a fairly bleak picture.
I want to delve in a little bit into your analysis of how this operates. You have one example of sort of open disdain for facts, people in power who take sets of known facts, something that is true, Barack Obama is an American and was born here, and simply refutes it, questions it, and opens up a whole new area of debate.
Yeah, the term I have for this is verification in reverse. Journalism is the art of verification. It's taking things that might be true and nailing it down with facts, with documents, with interviews. Verification in reverse is when you take something that's already been nailed down and you introduce doubt about it. And that releases a lot of energy, controversy, furor, news coverage that you can resent. And with that energy, you can try and power a political movement. And that is how Donald Trump started his political career when he became a birther. And so when verification in reverse becomes almost a basic technique of politics, you have not just a story that's hard to cover, You have the craft of journalism being pulled out by its roots. And that's what's so disturbing about what's going on.
So I'm a listener. I'm a viewer. I crack the newspaper. I'm listening to public radio. I hear a report that reports the new fact. All right. Donald Trump said today he had an historic electoral victory, a historic victory, which is something that he said, something that is demonstrably false. A great deal of coverage. Donald Trump said this. That was the news cycle for half a day.
Right. And what's interesting about that is that it's transparently false. That is, it's easy to check. It would take 5 minutes to figure out, maybe less. And when the press points out, well, not really, they are casting themselves as these sort of petty antagonists to the man in power. And even though he's wrong, he can still win the sort of symbolic fight because they seem like carping trivial critics and he seems like the man who's bravely fending off their attacks. And so even fact-checking somebody who doesn't care about facts is really difficult. Another thing that's interesting here, Todd, is last night in reacting to the sanctions against Russia, Trump said something interesting. He said, no one knows what's going on with computers today. And I thought that was really fascinating because, especially during the Cold War, all of our presidents have tried to give us the impression that, of course, they know what's going on. They're the leader of the free world. They're at the apex of this information system, which is the best in the world. And Trump not only doesn't mind, but he seems to advertise the impossibility of knowing what's going on. And that is really scary because it's not just sort of pushing journalists out of the frame. It's saying to Americans, don't bother paying attention. Don't bother trying to become informed because no one really knows what's going on.
There's an implicit resignation there. What are you going to do?
What are you going to do? And it's of a piece with his willingness to tolerate confusion within his camp about what does Trump actually intend to do. If his advisors say one thing and he says something completely different, that's not a problem. That actually helps him produce this atmosphere of confusion in which he's always right to his hardcore supporters. And to those who are skeptical, you can't figure out what's going on. Well, anybody who's studied or lived under an authoritarian regime knows that this is a basic tool of power.
So you point out, despite all of that, we still have a First Amendment. We still have a free press. We still have free speech and all of these things, of course, that we hold so dear. That's all fine, stipulated. There's a lot to be angry about and nervous about in some of those authoritarian strategies. What else is your recommendation for how a free press and a press that cares about the truth and frankly, a press that needs to make money, let's be honest, can operate in this environment in a way that serves people?
Well, there's two things that I think are really important. One is the press has to realize that it is a public institution that's in the middle of a political fight in the sense that there are organized forces that want to bring the press down. They want to turn the public against it. They want to make sure that nothing the mainstream press does makes a difference. And they're in a fight for support with the middle of the country. Trump's hardcore supporters are lost to mainstream journalism. But that's only 20 to 40% of the electorate. The rest have to be engaged. And if they come to the support of the press, that makes a difference. It's already happening with people signing up to subscribe to news sources that they believe in, supporting public radio, ProPublica.org, The Guardian, The New York Times, Washington Post. That's a vote of support. So journalists aren't accustomed to think of themselves as a political actor in a fight, but that's exactly their situation right now. The other thing that I think is really important is that journalists have to somehow learn to listen to Americans, understand their troubles better than the political system does, so that when the political system is ignoring those troubles, the press is not. And that's where the insiderism of a lot of political reporting, the concentration in New York and Washington, the culture of the press in which pundits and experts and office holders and journalists are all sort of part of the same world become huge problems.
What can news consumers do, do you think, to make their consumption more effective, to stay away from false balance, frankly, to stay away from the things that have worked financially that are driving an industry where everybody has to make a living?
People ask me this all the time.
It's a tough one.
Yeah. What I usually tell them is, first, they should support the news organizations that they think do a good job. And that means supporting them with money as well as attention. They should find individual journalists they trust and defend them when they're attacked, as well as follow their work. And individual citizens, voters, have to piece together their understanding of the world themselves. They can't get it prepackaged from the media. They can't get it from their ideology. And that illusion that you can sort of be delivered an understanding of the world watching cable news or getting your morning newscast is actually part of the problem. So people are going to have to like work harder, and they're going to have to start seeing news as a public good. And that's a long way from the system that got us to this point.
Jay Rosen is a professor of journalism at New York University. He's the author of Press Think, which you can read at pressthink.org, where you will find his new two-part post on the state of American journalism in the era of Trump, and also today, what can be done about it. Jay Rosen, it's great to have you here.
Thank you, Todd.
Persona non grata, the unpleasant person. It's one of the gravest diplomatic badges you can wear, and the United States slapped it on 35 Russians suspected of being intelligence operatives and kicked them out of the country. The White House also shut down two estates used by the Russian government here on U.S. soil. The Kremlin has vowed to respond, but not even a few hours after Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said in remarks broadcast on national TV that Russia would expel 35 American diplomats in response, Vladimir Putin said he had no plans to do so. Meanwhile, the FBI and Department of Homeland Security released a new report Thursday. It showed how Russian civilian and military intelligence services acted to influence the American election, a malicious cyber attack that the U.S. government is officially referring to as Grizzly Step. Joining us is Kimberly Martin. She's professor of political science at Barnard College at Columbia University. Kimberly, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Great to be back, Todd.
So what do you make of the timing of the sanctions against Russia and the individuals and organizations involved? I mean, the White House has known about the hacking since at least early summer. There was an election coming. We all know that. What do you make of the right now?
I think they wanted to have all of their ducks lined up to make sure that they could really say something significant about what the evidence was of the Russians being responsible for this. I also think that they wanted to leave the administration that's coming in with something that's very hard to undo. I think it's significant that Obama did not choose to put on any sanctions that affect American businesses, anything that would have any impact on the Russian oil industry. The sanctions are put on Russian intelligence agencies. And it's going to be very hard for incoming President Trump to explain why he doesn't think sanctions against Russian intelligence are not a good idea.
And a whole host of Russian individuals who the White House says effectively are foreign spies or at least operatives.
Yes, and that's significant, too. It's been a while since we've had this level of expulsion of Russians. And so I think that that's about as strong as you can get in terms of expressing diplomatic displeasure. And in terms of the timing, by the way, New Year's is the most important holiday in Russia. And so it actually gave these people the maximum inconvenience in terms of having to pack up and leave in 72 hours.
So that's interesting, maximum inconvenience, because do you think these sanctions are designed to really hurt Russian institutions, in this case, the intelligence service, military intelligence, or are they more designed to show action?
The most significant part of it is the attribution. And the reason that that's significant is because it says, Russia, we know that you're behind this. You can't get away with it. It's going to have an effect on U.S. allies who have elections coming up. France and Germany are both very concerned about Russian hacking into their electoral systems. And, it might, in the long run, actually lead to cooperation. And the reason that that's the case is that it did with China in 2015, when the United States was willing to say it's the Chinese military that is responsible for the hacking of the Office of Personnel Management in the United States, and we're going to put sanctions against the individuals that were responsible for that hack. It let China know that the United States could take action and could go out with public attribution. And a lot of people believe it led to the agreement that seems to be largely working. And so maybe it's actually giving Trump a gift, because if he takes hold of this and runs with it early in his administration, he might be able to get an agreement with Russia to limit the hacking of each other.
So maybe a gift to Donald Trump. But of course, the difference between 2015 and the Chinese and now, or one of the key differences, is that we have a change in administration coming in just 3 weeks. Donald Trump said yesterday, kind of with resignation, it's time for everyone to just move on with our lives. I'm not really interested in this. But yes, okay, I'll take an intelligence briefing on the Russian hacks. He doesn't seem like the guy who's going to turn around and really lean on the Russians about this.
Well, a couple things to think about. He faces some pretty strong Republican opposition to his statements about Russia. And so he has to take account to what his own party is thinking about these things. And I think it was actually pretty wise of Obama not to put the sanctions against economic actors, not to put the sanctions against U.S. oil companies, because it's going to be really hard for Trump to come in and say, oh, we don't want to have sanctions against the Russian intelligence agencies. Who's in favor of the Russian intelligence agencies in the United States? It would take a very strong a political statement by Trump that he's actually pro-Russian to undo these sanctions.
So Donald Trump's advisor, Kellyanne Conway, one of his spokespersons on CNN last night, complained that Barack Obama is trying to box Donald Trump in. It seems like she's right. That's one of the factors here.
I think he is trying to box Donald Trump in, but in a very creative way, because he really, what is the situation now is that this annoyed Russia, and Trump can undo it, but I don't think he can undo it without really getting something significant from Russia in return in order to keep the peace in his own party. And so that's why I think it might actually be a positive step that leads to some kind of an agreement on limiting hacking. It was sort of surprising that Russia was not willing to go along in 2015 with this major agreement that the U.S. and China signed. And maybe this will be the extra little incentive on both sides to get that kind of a new agreement in place.
So based on what you've seen so far, Kimberly Martin, ever since the summer or even before, during the presidential campaign, this entire hacking episode, would you say that the Russians are now emboldened by this grand experiment they've run on the United States, its people, its media, its politicians, and the United States' reaction to it? What's the takeaway lesson for the Russians right now?
Well, I think they were emboldened, and I think that this latest set of sanctions and other actions says to the Russians, watch out. We know what you're doing. We're willing to go on the record and attribute these things to you so you can't get away with it. We're sending a message to our allies to be on the lookout for what it is you're doing. We'll share the specific people who were involved. We'll share the websites that were involved. We'll share some of the techniques that were involved. And so you are now on public display for what you're doing. Can it stop the Russians from doing it? No, but maybe it can cause them to stop and think about whether it is actually such a low-cost action going forward.
Kimberly Martin is professor of political science at Barnard College at Columbia University. Kimberly, it's always great to have you.
Thank you, Todd. Great to be here.
At a particularly chilly moment for U.S.-Russia relations, physicist Richard Garwin can recall what made it downright cold, because he was part of it. Back in 1952, Garwin famously helped design the very first hydrogen bomb. It was codenamed Ivy Mike. And since that time, Richard Garwin has become a well-known activist on nonproliferation and nuclear arms control, and recalled for me a speech he gave more than 20 years ago that he could have written today.
In October 1994, I gave a talk at the 60th birthday celebration of Carl Sagan at Cornell University, The Relationship of Science and Power. And here are the closing paragraphs. Democracy, which we prize, contains the seeds of its own destruction. The power to choose includes the power to choose wrong. In Russia, there is a hazard of rejection of democracy, but also in the United States. Unless we provide more effectively the public goods of security against crime, of employment and health care, I see a real threat of the electorate choosing remedies that will lead to disaster. If those of us who have some power don't address these solutions because it is right to do so, we should do it because our future depends on their solution.
In November, he was awarded the 2016 Presidential Medal of Freedom for his work as a physicist, including his contributions to defense technologies and gravitational wave theory. Garwin's been a vocal supporter of the Iran nuclear deal, and he says the cooperation we've had with Russia on nonproliferation over the last few decades shouldn't be taken for granted.
Well, we've done very well, and cooperation with the Soviet Union and more recently with Russia has been a big part of that. But relations with Russia are not good now, and that's one of the main reasons to improve them. And the problem of a terrorist nuclear explosive, either stolen or given to them by a nuclear state, or made from stolen highly enriched uranium, is a big problem. And we need to continue cooperation with the other nuclear weapon states and the non-nuclear weapon states, members of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. That should be a very high priority.
What do everyday people misunderstand about how difficult or even how easy it is to either develop a weapon if you're a rogue group or steal one or steal the fuel for a nuclear device?
Well, it's all different, and stealing a modern nuclear weapon doesn't do you very much good because it has safety features. But stealing an elementary nuclear weapon gives you the opportunity to use it. So making an implosion weapon with plutonium is really quite difficult. Making an improvised nuclear weapon by obtaining highly enriched uranium metal, that's pretty easy. The goal has been over the last decades to lock up the highly enriched uranium. And there we've been really quite successful.
How did you react, Professor Garwin, when you saw President-elect Donald Trump's public statements that the United States should build up and expand its nuclear arsenal, not just modernize it as President Obama wants to do, but actually expand the arsenal?
I think that a good look at the realities of the situation after he takes office might persuade him differently. Our problem is not too few nuclear weapons, it's too many nuclear weapons, an exorbitant cost, a really unnecessary, in my opinion, modernization of the nuclear triad.
You wrote an open letter to President Obama in the summer of 2015, along with a bunch of other scientists and physicists, praising that Iran nuclear deal. You called it stringent and innovative. You're publishing a message to the new president, Donald Trump. What's your message to him?
Well, we have almost a year after the implementation of the Iran deal, January 2016, and it has really been working very well. The verification by the International Atomic Energy Agency has worked. The centrifuge farm has been reduced by two-thirds. The enriched uranium stockpile in Iran has been reduced by 95 or 98%. We are much farther from an Iran nuclear weapon or from having the material for Iran to use in a nuclear weapon than was the case before.
Well, you're one of the few people around talking about this issue, Professor Garwin, who actually helped develop the very first nuclear weapons, the first hydrogen bomb. I wonder throughout your career how you've looked back on that innovation that you helped make, especially in light of the proliferation questions that the world is facing now.
If I hadn't helped develop the first thermonuclear weapon, other people would have. It would probably have taken a year or two longer. I wish that hydrogen bombs were not possible, but reality is what it is. You have to face it. And we could have had a nuclear deterrent with just plain old fission bombs or boosted fission bombs, and now we have it with considerably lower yield hydrogen bombs than the first generation that we had.
It's a very different environment than 1961, 1962, the Cuban Missile Crisis, when JFK was president, somebody who you knew and worked with.
Yes, I had a one-on-one or almost one-on-one, with President Kennedy just after the United States had detonated a hydrogen bomb at 400-kilometer altitude, 1.4 megatons, the Starfish Prime experiment in 1962. And it had filled the Van Allen belts with trapped electrons so that one could not send an astronaut to the moon and bring him back safely within the decade, as President Kennedy had promised. So this was a big concern of his. Fortunately, there are natural phenomena that took care of the excess electron population and made it possible for the Apollo landings and safe return.
You know, Professor, while I still have you here, if you'll let me, you did some pioneering work in the area of gravitational waves. And I just need to ask you about it if I can, because it's a rare opportunity for me. Those gravitational waves have been detected and confirmed now. They've been called the smoking gun of the Big Bang and inflation right after the Big Bang. It could help explain a lot about this universe and maybe even a multiverse, infinite other universes. It's an exciting time for a guy like you, I think.
The Laser Interferometer Gravitational Observatory, LIGO, detection of gravity waves, was wonderful. My involvement was limited. My admiration is unlimited. I did do gravity wave experiments on my own in the early 1970s, and I showed that the earlier experiments by Joe Weber were wrong, that gravity waves had not been detected. And I helped bring the laser interferometer effort on track. I do little science for the most part. These people do big science, teams of 1,000 people or more, all managed really wonderfully toward a positive goal. And that's the sort of thing that we need, not only in the detection of the merger of two enormous black holes, but we need such efforts on behalf of humanity to solve our social problems.
Richard Garwin, physicist, anti-proliferation activist, nuclear expert, recipient of the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Professor Richard Garwin, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Have you ever seen a commie drink a glass of water?
What?
Why do you want a little bit? Because if you're going to drink, I'd rather you do it in the house.
Why do you think I'm calling you? Just to say hello?
Did you see the memo about this?
And you won't be angry?
I will not be angry.
This is healthy. This is good.
Friday's movie day here on The Takeaway, when we talk about the weekend's big movie releases. There were no big releases this Friday, at least there aren't any coming up. But if you were standing around online for Rogue One, which I was, and probably you were too, you might have missed some of the other great films that are around this month. And that's why Rafer Guzman is here. He's film critic for Newsday and for us here on The Takeaway. Rafer, good to see you.
Hey, Todd.
Let's start off today with Lion from director Garth Davis. This is starring Nicole Kidman and Dev Patel. I saw this movie over the holidays. It's a fine, fine story. This is a story of a little boy, poor, in Calcutta, India, gets lost and separated from his family and goes on a grand journey. Listen.
Do you have any idea what it's like knowing my real brother and mother spent every day of their lives looking for me? Huh? 25 years, Luce. 25! I have to find her. They need to know I'm okay.
Rafer, this was a film that really took its time with a lot of things. I thought it was beautiful, to be honest.
Well, I mean, so you've seen the first half of this film, which is really the grabber in this movie. The little boy, played by Sonny Pawar, such an amazing performance as this kid who is separated from his family, takes this journey across India, winds up homeless, and then there's Dev Patel, we just heard, who plays him as an adult and who decides to go back to India and try to find them. That first half of the film with that little boy is so moving, so harrowing, that I think that kind of carries you through the rest of the film through some parts that aren't quite as interesting. To me, when he's looking for his family, when he's in Australia looking for his family, it's not that interesting because he's mostly on the computer,
Google
you know,
Maps.
Using Google Earth, exactly. And it's an amazing story. We should note that this is a true story. This really happened. An amazing determination to try to pick out, you know, where his family could possibly be in a country as huge as India. And he does it. It's amazing. But I think it's that first half of the film with that amazing performance performance by this little boy that really carries you through the whole thing.
Harrowing and hard to watch in a film, especially in that first half, that really takes its time and tells an amazing story there. Let's move on to Hidden Figures. A lot of people have been talking about this movie. The story of some of the African-American women scientists at NASA who provided a lot of the data key to John Glenn's first orbit into space that may have been overlooked by history.
Ruth, what's the status on that computer?
She's right behind you, Mr. Harrison.
Does she handle analytic geometry?
Absolutely. And she speaks.
Yes, sir, I do.
Which one?
Both. Geometry and speaking.
You think you can find me the Frenet frame for this data? Using the Gram-Schmidt...
orthogonalization algorithm? Yes, sir. I prefer it over Euclidean coordinates.
Refer?
So that's Taraji P. Henson playing one of the computers, as they used to call them, a human mathematician, but they called them computers back then. Octavia Spencer is also in this film. She plays a woman who discovers one of the first actual computers, what we now call computers, and teaches herself how to program it. Janelle Monáe, the pop singer, plays a woman who wants to be an engineer. Amazing cast. They're all so much fun. And it's such an upbeat, great movie about a serious topic, though. And I think the movie is very clear-eyed about the way racism operates in America. There aren't any real syrupy, corny moments in this film. You know, that's Kevin Costner we heard there, who does play a little bit of a white savior here and there. But mostly this is really these women's stories trying to break the color barrier and the glass ceiling at NASA. And it's a lot of fun, great cast. I think you're going to see a lot of Oscar coming out of this movie.
That's Hidden Figures, and especially poignant in this year when John Glenn passed away.
Yes.
So there's a bit of the backstory there. Let's do a quick hit on Silence. This is the new one from Martin Scorsese, starring Liam Neeson. He always makes big news with a new film. How's Silence?
Yeah, so this is the story of Jesuit priests in 17th century Japan, you know, trying to spread Christianity at the risk of their own lives. You might say this is sort of Kundun Redux. I think it's a different film than that. Strong, but not Scorsese's strongest, I would say.
Not Scorsese's strongest. Hidden Figures and Lion might be two films that you want to get out and see if you have some time over the weekend, if you miss them during December. Rafer Guzman of Newsday and here at The Takeaway. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Todd.
Happy New Year.
You too.
Did you ever wonder what was going on in Cyndi Lauper's life when she wrote Time After Time? Every hit song, at least the ones that go deeper than I Just Want to Party, has a story to tell. And that's where Mark Myers comes in. Myers has interviewed dozens of legendary artists, as well as their collaborators and producers and engineers, to get the real story behind their hit music, all the way from Cyndi Lauper, but also the Rolling Stones, Elvis Presley, Blondie, you name it. Well, now, Mark Myers has compiled a list of dozens of these tales in a new book. It's called Anatomy of a Song, The Oral History of 45 Iconic Hits That Changed Rock, R&B, and Pop. We picked a few to talk about with Mark, and we started off with Tammy Wynette's Stand By Your Man. It was a ballad that came to be interpreted as an answer to women's liberation, although that was never Tammy Wynette's intention.
Tammy never meant it that way. The way she meant it originally was, as Billy Sherrill told me, was as if she were giving advice to another woman trying to hold on to her man. There was no statement about the cosmology at all. She was simply expressing advice to another woman on how to hang on to a guy she really loved. The whole furor came about when Epic Records decided to run a full-page ad that simply said Tammy Wynette's answer to women's lib. She had nothing to do with that. It was a marketing gag by Epic, and that's how it wound up as sort of being this reactionary, old-fashioned, out-of-sync way to hang on to men.
All right, Mark Myers, here's an iconic song that we chose because I think there might even be some similarities, at least to the spirit of Stand By Your Man that we just talked about.
He's said he's going back to a simpler place and time.
Mark Myers, that's Gladys Knight and the Pips. I've never been able to hear that song come on without kind of stopping what I'm doing and listening. But this song is about a woman who quits her life because a guy couldn't cut it in L.A. And she kind of stands by her man in a way.
Yeah, what's fascinating is that it's coming through a woman's voice, so that perspective is stark. But this was not originally a woman who wrote it, and it wasn't originally for a woman's voice. Jim Weatherly, the songwriter, wrote it as a country ballad that he recorded first. And then his manager sent out his album of songs to high-profile singers, hoping they would pick it up and turn into a hit. And the first artist who grabbed it in 1972 is Sissy Houston. It was originally Midnight Plane to Houston, but she wanted to change it to Midnight Train to Georgia. And what she said to him is, look, my folks aren't from Houston. They're from Georgia. And we don't take planes. We take trains. And he said, fine.
It just wouldn't have worked as, you know, Pan Am Flight 708 to Houston. You know?
Yeah.
All right, I want people to sort of reset their minds here, cleanse your palate. We're going across the Atlantic. This is a different feel, a different sound. Brace yourself. This is the heavy riff. This is Zeppelin. Jimmy Page revolutionized rock and roll with that heavy riff, that repetitious heavy guitar sound. Nobody had ever really done it before. That's on display here. What's going on with Whole Lotta Love?
You know, he did. He actually was inspired by rockabilly. He wanted to open that with a big rockabilly-like opening, which is, you know, what he was most captured by in terms of American music. But they really detested AM radio. AM radio, they felt, was the children's table at this point. FM radio had already come on air in a big way in 68. And Page simply did not want to see his music carved down to slider-sized songs. He wanted full canvas, big canvas recordings for albums with his work. But what happens is that they record it. They record as long as they possibly can on a song like this. And the record company issues it at about 5 minutes initially. But then they decide to bring it down to about 3 minutes and 21 seconds. And Page said he told me he listened to it once and never listened to it again. He hated it.
All right, let's stay in London. Let's get the Clash.
The ice is coming. The sun's zooming in. Meltdown expected. The wheat is going thin. Engines stop running, but I have no fear, 'cause London is drowning. I live by the river.
That's the great Joe Strummer there, of course, lead man for the Clash. Mark Myers, I love punk. I love music with something to say. I love the history of social conflict in London and in New York that led to punk. But I was shocked in your book to read that the real thing that these guys were afraid of when they wrote this song was rising sea levels.
They were ahead of the curve when it comes to global warming. Joe Strummer lived down by the Thames River there, and they were terribly afraid that the Thames was going to back up and flood the city, which had been the case earlier. And this is before London put up those barriers to stop that from happening. The other thing that was in their favor is the change in politics there with Margaret Thatcher coming in 79. Punk, which had been backpedaling for a bit, sort of was played out by 1979, even in London, they realized that they could latch punk onto social commentary and become almost a protest band against economics and against the deterioration in London, which they did artfully.
All right, the Ramones went to London. They played some punk. They helped start a movement. They came back to New York. They played in CBGB in Manhattan, and they had a friend there who was also playing punk, and then she did something different that made a lot of her punk friends really mad. Her name is Debbie Harry. You know her as Blondie, and she did this.
Kids would come up and said, play that disco song. This is the first marriage of disco and punk in the 1970s. Then the song became Once I Had a Love by 1978. And when they start to record their album in 1978, Parallel Lines, the producer, Michael Chapman, he wants to find out how he can take this song and turn it into a really big hit. So he asks Debbie Harry, he says to her, who's your biggest influence vocally now? And she says, Donna Summer. So suddenly a light bulb goes off over Chapman's head to create this Giorgio Moroder Kraftwerk feel for this song called Once I Had a Love. He wants the name changed. They change it to Heart of Glass. You can hear Donna Summer in Debbie Harry's voice, that ooh, that's Donna Summer in I Feel Love.
Mark Myers is the author of Anatomy of a Song, the oral history of 45 iconic hits that changed rock, R&B, and pop. Mark Myers, thanks so much.
Beautiful to be here, Todd. Thank you.
And before we leave you for this final time in 2016, you're helping us reflect back on some of the highs and lows of the year.
Army beat Navy for the first time in many years. What a treat.
My high point was definitely the birth of my beautiful baby girl.
I was disappointed this year with the continuing corporate capitalist takeover of America. But I'm a 3-year cancer survivor, so every day I wake up is a high point.
2016, I broke up with my partner 2.5 years, and it was a really dark time. But at the same time, I did a lot of work on my mental health.
On another note, so many stars and musicians and scientists who have been pivotal in culture and knowledge have died this year. It's been a roller coaster ride.
Well, if you're one of the people who's decided they can't stand one more second of the 2016 roller coaster, here's a little bit of bad news. The rotation of the Earth is a little wobbly, and that means an extra second is being added to the world's clocks tomorrow night. I hope you get through it, and we'll see you on the other side. Have a happy new year and be safe. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry. We'll talk to you again in 2017. This is The Takeaway.